KLOB 100.5 FM.
You're listening to 100.5 FM. Steve Gruber from Michigan is going to join us at 9:45. So let's quickly go to the phone lines. You're on the LynnLibby.com listener line. Good morning.
Good morning. It's Arthur down east.
Yes, sir.
And hey, Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah to those who are anticipating the Festival of Light. And we're into a very blessed time of the year. So, I keep hearing people, like a recent caller, I think, so how do we do something else? Ross Perot spent the equivalent of about $120 million today to get less than 20% of the vote, and about 10 to 15% of the vote is angry all the time and is looking for some way to vote against something. And all he did was elect President Clinton in the end. He had a vendetta against the Bush family. He felt it had been a slight, whatever, doesn't matter. The end result is Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, who still is not gone away. And that's Ross Perot's gift to us, trying to do something else. And he actually had a little bit of money, and he had national name recognition because of what he did rescuing those hostages with a private, you know, military group he hired.
Right, but I'm not going to ever discourage somebody, even a Democrat, from running for office, and I'm never going to discourage somebody who wants to go out and explore their political possibilities, maybe start a new party or whatever. So, you know, if that's something that they all want to do, then that's fine with me. I think they need to recognize the reality.
What does it take? The question was, what does it take? And I wrote this in a paper for a bunch of candidates a long time ago. Unless you have 60 people who will regularly give up their time and their money for at least 3 to 6 months, you're not competitive in any politics anywhere. If you have that, you have the potential in this country to get into the U.S. House. When people use the word we in politics, I always say you and which mouse. When you have every month you can put 60 paying people in seats in a meeting group, whether they're just there to ask or find out or they're committed, then you're starting to approach we. And until then, it's just all good heart and good caring and admirable. And I totally support you. I entirely admire anybody who puts himself up for public office. And our founding words were, we the people, not they ought to. So anyway, just wanted to share that thought.
Yeah, no, well, makes a lot of sense.
It's interesting.
Appreciate the phone call. Thank you.
In 92, when Perot ran the first time, he was winning when he dropped out.
Right.
In, I think, August.
I think he would have won the election had he stayed in.
And it came out, there were rumors that there were threats on his family and tight behind-the-scenes things that forced him out. Then he thought better of it, came back in, but it was too late. He still ended up getting 20-something.
Well, he beat Bush here. He came in second in Maine. It was Clinton, Perot, and Bush in Maine. I do believe this, and I said it at the time. I wasn't involved in radio, but I was involved in politics, that I thought Ross Perot was going to win. And I thought they were going to win because Bill Clinton, his personal character traits disqualified him in the minds of many. And as you may recall, he got a very small percentage of what we would call, what I call the aggregate. And George H.W. Bush, and I remember so distinctly having this conversation with my mother on election night, we were on the phone together and watching him give his concession speech. And she asked me, are you watching him? And I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, are you looking at his face? And I said, yes, ma'am. She said, he looks relieved, doesn't he? I said, yes, ma'am, he does.
Wait, sorry, whose concession?
George H.W., his concession speech.
In 92.
George H.W., I think, accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. He wanted to be president because it's something he wanted to be. His father, Prescott, was never president. He was the United States Senator. George had done it all. Vice president, congressman, head of the CIA, ambassador. He had done everything except be president of the United States, which we know he wanted to do in 1980 when he and Reagan tangled for the nomination. And I think by serving 4 years, he had gotten beaten up. He had gone from great heights the year before. His approval rating nationally was 91% after Desert Storm. And then he cratered just completely. And he ran a campaign that was not only lackluster, but the media gave the appearance of him that he was out of touch with the people. And he never did anything to change that narrative. And throughout the campaign, never did anything at all to change. And I think Ross Perot would have won. Perot, when he would sit on television for half an hour and talk about the sucking sound down south. I mean, all of those things connected with the people. But when he dropped out and then got back in, he looked like a kook, so they wouldn't vote for him.
Yeah.
I think Bill Clinton that year talked about being the comeback kid.
Mm.
I think part of the reason he was the comeback kid is because he refused to go down.
Yeah, I mean, Trump is the ultimate comeback kid now.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
America loves a comeback story.
Absolutely.
There's that great movie, Primary Colors, about that 92 campaign that gives a good flavor of the Clinton era.
If you believe that story.
Well, just a great movie.
Yeah, and, no, I agree. But if you believe that story.
Oh, yeah.
If you believe that book and you believe that story,
yeah.
Everything that's happened since should be no surprise to you.
Right.
Because there were no boundaries with these people.
Right. And if you look, there's that great clip.
And you don't know this. There's no way you would. But Juanita Broderick, and again, I'm not best friends with her.
Uh-huh.
We keep in touch. But she sat on the station one day for an hour giving vivid detail of when Bill Clinton raped her in the hotel.
Well, there's a whole, that's a whole.
And then she talked about how Hillary threatened her if she came public.
Months worth of shows there.
And then how, what is the woman's name? Andrea Mitchell. How Andrea Mitchell called her and threatened her if she exposed Bill.
Bill's a great example of, like, if you play ball with the whole system and the way that politicians are intended to in that system, then you're going to coast through no matter what, virtually.
Yeah. Right.
But if you step out, then the anonymous sourcing, the innuendo, it'll turn into this scandalous thing. Also, no matter what, even if you're a choir boy.
Well, I think Bill Clinton learned from Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon could have survived all of this, I believe, and he certainly would have survived today, if he had played more ball with the establishment. Bill Clinton just simply figured out, if I just wait them out, I win.
But he also played ball and was always up for
anything. No. And Nixon didn't do that.
But in terms of a principled stand, to try to synergize our talks today, from JFK's assassination, when he was trying to de-escalate Vietnam and other things related to the gold standard and things that we know, that he was assassinated. And then effectively the message was sent that if you're going to be independently minded at that level of power, you're gonna have to face that type of threat. And that was a big deterrent for those kinds of people entering politics. And we're living in a world created by folks without that kind of fortitude. And it took that kind of fortitude to take stances. When Perot did it in 92, I think that he was threatened in that level and as we said, stepped out. And then it took effectively, Nixon couldn't.
Do you think he was actually threatened?
Yeah, I think that.
Because he says that the Bush people threatened to assassinate him at his daughter's wedding. That was the premise that he stepped away from the election. Do you actually believe that?
It wouldn't surprise me at all. Whether that particular thing is true, I think that kind of pressure was brought to bear.
Yeah, and I will say this. When that all first came out, I might have believed it. But in the aftermath of the election, in the aftermath of this very sanguine, lackluster, lack of a pulse campaign that George H.W. ran to be reelected, I can't imagine they would have assassinated someone to win when they didn't try to win in the campaign. And I believe they didn't try.
Well, you know, threats aren't necessarily meant to be followed through on.
No, I know that. But he claims that the Bush team threatened to assassinate him at his daughter's wedding. I just found that to be specious. Yeah. I did.
I mean,
found
most likely specious. In my experience, a threat like that is real, but not from the obvious suspect.
Yeah.
You know, so he probably got it.
Well, he must have thought it was serious, or maybe he was, in fact, a kook, and I don't know which.
Yeah, you can imagine a million scenarios.
You can.
But I think that Butler in Pennsylvania on July 13th, surviving that assassin's bullet, had to happen. That was like the necessary conflict that had to be prevailed through in the political realm to be at this level of power with a genuine agenda to help the American people as opposed to the way it's been. And it's so symbolic and also was so concrete. Because if it had succeeded and they had exploded his head on television for the world to see, talk about sending out a message. And Trump was such a unicorn, is such a unicorn with his talents and gifts and everything unique that and Vance wasn't even selected yet. I mean, that probably would have been the end of a lot of it.
Well, there's no question. Had he died, there would have. You're absolutely right about that. Let me ask you a different question. Do you believe we know the truth about Butler?
No, not at all. I mean,
that's part of the problem. And this is what I was saying to the caller earlier about the JFK assassination. It has led to such a deep distrust by people like me in the executioners of our government. Such a cavalier and careless circumstance to allow that roof to be exposed when it was identified as a potential place for an assassin to be. And allow it to be exposed was not done by happenstance. I don't believe it. I would, you know, the only way that somebody could convince me is to be able to time travel back to that and actually be a participant in the conversations. 130 yards away, an AR-15, I mean, that's like me throwing the football 25 yards, you know? 130 yards away and the roof's exposed. And the excuses are so crazy, and you had civilians clamoring at the authorities that he's on the roof with a gun, clamoring. You had a member of law enforcement, I use that term very broadly, recognizing he was on the roof, saw him there, and then stepped down from the roof. And there's just too much there. And then the fact that he was immediately, his body was disposed of, immediately. No opportunity for any true investigation. It just doesn't happen.
Well, he's got like three phones or accounts, yeah. And they still
it just doesn't happen.
It.
Well, if they were serious about truth, that wouldn't have happened. There would have been a detailed investigation. The body would have been held, and all kinds of stuff like that. They aren't serious about truth.
Well, there was also that attempt the following month or 2 months later, on the golf course.
Right. Sure.
And that was also, that was going to be even a shorter shot.
Right.
And the Secret Service agent saw him through the scope in the bushes.
And the thing about that is, though, think about that for a moment. In the aftermath of Butler, that was a known place at that golf course where the media constantly went in to get shots and that kind of thing. In other words, a known vulnerability in the aftermath of Butler.
Yep.
So again, and to the caller earlier, I am a skeptic of the executioners of our government. I don't believe them. I don't think they're people of good character. I think they've demonstrated that they've done everything they can to enrich and ingratiate themselves with money and power at the expense of the American people, but more importantly, at the expense of our government. Our government's financial position is in jeopardy. Our national security is jeopardized by our financial position, and there seems to be no recognition by anyone in government that something needs to be done about it, that there is no recognition by government that there needs to be a level of restraint about the scope and the activities of the government. It's just, what can we do?
Well, there's
and what
recognition
can we get
now.
Away with?
There's recognition
but there
now.
Was none, is my point. But this yeah. didn't happen overnight. When I was 18 years old, our government was $934 billion in debt. It's now $36 trillion and climbing in the space of 44 years.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was in high school, I remember it was $4 trillion. And that was all the talk.
Yeah.
And now it's 36.
I was convinced that at $10 trillion, our government would default and collapse and have to be restructured. And then when that didn't happen, I was convinced it was 15, and then I could convinced it was 20. And when we got to 21 and nothing happened and no recognition that maybe we ought to put the brakes on and do some real reform, I just said, these people will spend us into proverbial hell if they can.
Yeah, we really didn't.
With no consequence.
We really didn't have any time to spare in terms of turning it around if God willing that's going to happen, because when interest rates were so low for so long that the effect was muted, but now that interest rates are significantly higher and then you've heard like more is spent on interest on that debt than the military budget. It's like $1 trillion a year just on the interest. And it's becoming a runaway train. I think Bannon said the other day, like when he went in for his 4-month prison sentence, it was $35 trillion. And when he came out after the 4-month prison sentence, it was $36 trillion. So $1 trillion every 4 months.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
It's a problem.
I mean, it's bizarre is what it is. The lack of recognition, they've destabilized the dollar and devalued it. We now have nations actively trying to undermine the dollar as the currency of commerce around the planet. If that were to happen, and I believe under Trump it won't, because it'll be a great punishment for those nations. He's been very clear, if you seek to do this, we will punish you. And I think they believe him. But Trump won't be there but 4 years. Hopefully J.D. Vance will learn, you know, at his knee, so to speak, and whatever it is he has inside of him will be revealed as a leader. But if the dollar is no longer the currency of commerce around the world, our nation's government will collapse. People don't even understand this, but it will happen.
Yeah, it's not a joke. It's interesting. If the Hegseth pick doesn't work out, Trump is talking about DeSantis for Secretary of Defense. Which is cool, you know, in terms of making peace with such a recent rival. And how.
Well, I think it's also cool because you look at his ability to lead a large organization and to do extraordinary things with it. The people of Florida are happy with their government. That doesn't mean they agree with everything he's done. I mean, he's been bold in some arenas, like taking on Disney and also getting sexual indoctrination out of the schools at the young part of the school age and the elementary schools. It's not that everybody agrees with everything DeSantis has done, but overall they're satisfied with the operation of the government. I know when I lived there, that was not the case.
I think
there was a lot of unrest. He's an excellent manager. He has a military background. There's a lot of possibility with Ron DeSantis.
I think what Trump's doing in real time is operationalizing his increased popularity in a way that he wasn't able to before. Because before he was on such a razor's edge that every fight had to be fought to the hilt with no back down. But now with more support and genuinely popular authority, he's freed up, as he showed with Gates and as he's implying here with Hegseth. He can take a little L and roll with it like it's nothing. Because he's like, okay, good job, guys. On to the next. And he just is going to bring a fire hose of merit-based work. And it's not all going to work out. Maybe it'll be 60% success rate, 70, 80, 90, 95. But he seems to recognize there's going to be some hiccups, and he's has backup plans, and he's ready to roll, and he's going to let everyone know that the backup might be worse than the thing you thought was the worst.
I think what you just said should be expounded upon, because I believe with the Gates thing, he is so strategic and he understands that he can afford, as you said, a little L here. I think that he orchestrated the Gates thing for precisely the reasons that I said before, to help out an ally, to avoid embarrassing circumstance or potentially embarrassing circumstance. And I think he did all that. I mentioned to you that, and I think I mentioned to the audience, I'd been texting with Matt Whitaker, and I asked him flat out, was this, what do they call it, a cheap fake or whatever? And he's going to appoint you. And he texted and said, or Pam.
Mm.
And that was well before it happened. So for me, I think he thinks in a way, you know, that's different here. It's a strategic thinking. And he knew he could afford a little capital here if he needed to. I don't think it cost him any capital, because the pick of Pam Bondi was so universally and widely hailed.
Well, the message being sent to the opponent is, we're in such a strong position now right. that even your victories are meaningless.
Right.
So Matt Gaetz is up. Now they're just scared. Is he going to be a special prosecutor in three
absolutely.
Months?
Absolutely. You're completely right about that. And you know, I think that you made a point that is so worth repeating, because when was the last time we looked at it this way, that the Republican Party deep bench? That is something Trump has done. People can blame him for whatever they want. But what he has really done is he has brought in his adversaries and made them allies. Rand Paul's a great example. You remember in 16, they were on the stage together, and he looks down at him on the end of the stage and said, what are you doing here? You're at 1% in the polls. You shouldn't even be on the stage. Now, that's an embarrassing moment in the national lexicon, if you will. And plus, Rand Paul was the United States Senator. He was not an inconsequential guy. 5-6 years ago, IMC at an event here with Rand Paul in the state of Maine. I had a chance to spend some time talking with him behind the scenes, just one-on-one. And basically, he said, look, you know, I play golf with Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. He's one of the most brilliant strategic people I've ever met. I didn't know those things at the time, but I know them now.
Mm-hmm.
And David Jones actually drove him to the airport down in Boston. So he spent 2 hours with him. And Rand really expanded on that, what he said to me in probably a 10-minute conversation. He spent 2 hours talking to David about it. And he said, you know, Trump has turned adversaries into allies like you wouldn't believe. Not every one of them, obviously. He's got a lot of adversaries. But strategic adversaries have become strategic allies.
Well, he's totally...
Lindsey Graham. I mean, he gave out Lindsey Graham's cell phone.
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, right, sure.
Kim Jong-un.
I don't know if he's an ally, but he certainly settled him down, didn't he?
I have a bigger red button and mine works.
Exactly.
And then if you read Kim Jong-un's letters to him just within the next 2 years, were some of the most beautiful letters that you can imagine between two men. That was not romantic.
No, it was not. But they all, you know how the media was. I remember when he said that, I heard it on the radio. We were riding somewhere and I just started singing, my button's bigger than your button. My button's bigger than yours. And if I push it, you won't be around. My button is bigger than yours.
Well, we were talking about, I think we had to go to break, but what he just did to Trudeau. I mean, Trudeau was just vicious to Trump over the last, the whole thing, right? Now Trudeau's on his way out. He's lost legitimacy in Canada. He's going out the door. But Trump put out that tweet about the tariffs. And Trudeau can't resist the limelight. And so he heads down to Mar-a-Lago and they have the meal and they're smiling. And Trump just makes that joke about if you need this $100 billion deficit with the United States, maybe Canada can become the 51st state and you could become the governor.
And what's so funny about that is people that have listened to the show, I have long advocated that we invade Canada, take it over and make it the 51st state. So funny. I've done that for over a decade.
Then he truthed out or tweeted out, whatever we say these days, the picture of him atop like a mountain range and and with the Canadian flag next to him and it says, "Oh, Canada" under it. I mean, it's just so next level of, I mean, it's like the best stand-up comedian whose material isn't just about like mom and grandma, but it's about like
reality.
The real most powerful situations behind the scenes. He lets us into it all and shows us it's all just people and looks like what happened with the recent pick for what was it, DEA chief, was a sheriff
down in Hillsborough County.
But then his base started pointing out all kinds of stuff he had done that was funky and things he had said that were funky, and Trump saw them, and then he pulled the nomination himself.
Right.
He's so focused on the merit. He's they call him huge ego, but yet he's comfortable surrounding himself
absolutely
with these giants, and he's correcting, self-correcting in real time, pulling a nomination like that. What, based on what? Just based on the people.
Right. Absolutely. No, I think that in his part is brilliant. And I mean, I'm just so excited about what next year, the possibility of what next year holds.
Well, I just paid $2.58 for a gallon of gas.
Yeah, you did? Where?
I get so much gas, I don't remember, but it was in the last few days, right around
$2.58.
Yeah, and that wasn't even like BJ's,
which is, by the way, still 22 cents higher than it was when he was left office. But still, that's really good.
But no, it is the lowest since 2021.
Yeah, right.
Trump hasn't even taken office yet.
Just think what happens when he floods the world market with beautiful American energy.
Well, he's just appointed real giants of strategic thinking at all these positions.
Right. We got to run. Dolph Sachs, great to see you. We will see you guys on the radio tomorrow.
We fix people by fixing their car. I like being part of that.
It's a great feeling knowing that you've done something that looks good and you know the customer is going to be happy with.
We're doing great. I love my job. I love what I do and all my coworkers.
All the women that work here are fantastic and they want to be part of something bigger.
My future looks great.